Thursday, November 3rd. That's the good news. The bad news is you got to travel to Rochester, Michigan in order to get there. So if any of you can hijack a bus or a car or something of the sort and get down to Rochester, which is north of Detroit, on Thursday the 3rd, it is free. It's worth only twice that much. And it will be from 7 to 10 p.m. The room hasn't been decided yet, but you get in touch with help. Is it astronomy or physics department? The physics department, this is the gentleman that did the arrangement, so it's his fault. And in fact, he can give you details about where, exactly where, how to get to the university, that kind of thing. You should be able to find out that information.
November 3rd.
November 3rd is Friday.
Is there always that day?
Okay, well, it's Friday, Thursday, November 2nd. See that way. The problem is we were operating between the 2nd and the 3rd, and that's why I'm confused. Okay, so any other questions about that or about anything that I've done up to this point, electric theories or whatever? Okay, let's get on to Phobos and Deimos then, the moons of Mars. So if we can have the lights out and the first slide on, show you all that. This gentleman is Asa Hall, one of our boys, a graduate of the University of Michigan. In 1877, which was 101 years ago, past August to be exact, and September for the other thing, there were two major discoveries made about Mars. One of them was the moons of Mars, which were discovered by Asa Hall in August of 1877. The other was the canals of Mars, which were discovered by Giovanni Schiaparelli in September. The canals do not exist. They were optical illusions. They are a snare and delusion. The moons very definitely exist, and they turn out to be very interesting, very tiny, but I think with interest all out of proportion to their size. The reason for this difference is that one of them was discovered by a graduate of the University of Michigan, and the other was not. Giovanni Schiaparelli was, as the name implies, an Italian astronomer. In fact, he was related to the bird designer or whatever. So who's the Schiaparelli that everybody knows? Dress designer? Something like that. Who? Okay. In any case, you know, whatever the guy does, he's related to them. The moons of Mars were discovered from Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Naval Observatory, and that showed you how far back all this was. If you've been to Washington recently and looked at the night sky, I think you will realize that it's not very easy to make major astronomical discoveries from there. But for a long time, all we knew about them was the fact that they existed and their orbits. Of course, their names, which Asa Hall was able to discover very shortly after he found out the moons themselves existed. He named them Phobos and Deimos. Here are pictures of them as seen from the Earth. Phobos is the brighter of the two, but also the nearer to Mars, and there it is. Deimos is just barely visible in this picture as that tiny little dot of light, and I think you see how difficult it was for him to discover them. He did discover them by looking through the telescope, not by photographs, but in general, they cannot be seen through any but very large telescope with very good conditions, and generally we study them by photographing. This particular picture has been faked a little bit. That big blur of light you see around Mars is on the original picture, the overexposed image of the planet Mars. The moon is so faint that you've got to overexpose Mars itself considerably, or else you're not going to be able to see them. And so in order to show you where Mars really would be, and the fact that it's smaller than the overexposed blob, they have simply fastened in at the right scale a picture of Mars was taken on another occasion with an exposure appropriate to it. What we knew about the moons of Mars after Hall discovered them, oh, the names, by the way, Phobos means fear, and it's related, it's the same root as the English word phobia comes from, and Deimos means terror, and these seem appropriate names for something associated with Mars, the god of war. However, where they really came from was that in the sixth book of the Iliad, they are the horses who draw the chariots of the god of war. And the suggestion was made by a gentleman with a classical inclination, whose name I forget, and Paul, of course, being discovered, got to name them, and he decided they liked those names, so that's what they're called. We knew their orbits, and we did not know their sizes, so I can tell us their brightness, and as you shall see, their sizes were systematically underestimated throughout the period before we had spacecraft photographs of them. We did know their orbits, though, and it became evident very quickly that Phobos is unique among all the natural moons in the solar system, although there are lots of artificial satellites of Earth that do this now, in that it revolves around Mars in less time than it takes for Mars to rotate its axis. In other words, a Phobos month is less than one Martian day. And Deimos is, in some It is the only natural satellite whose orbital height is almost the height at which it is at synchronous orbit. In other words, at which it would revolve around Mars at exactly the same period as Mars rotates on its axis. It's not exactly a synchronous orbit, but it's so close to it that Phobos would be visible in the Martian sky continuously day and night for 2.5 Martian days from rising to setting. Phobos would, since it is so close, is moving around Mars faster than Mars is rotating under it. And so its motion across the sky, as seen by an observer on the Martian surface, is due more to its own orbital motion than to the motion of the planet that seems to make the entire universe revolve around it. So if you watch our own moon from Earth, you will see that it seems to go across the sky from east to west like everything else in the sky, and it takes rather sophisticated observation, at least for the average person, to notice that it takes a little bit longer to travel across the sky from horizon to horizon than a star would, because the moon, while it's moving across the sky from horizon to horizon, is moving backwards somewhat in its own orbit. But the moon, of course, takes an entire month to revolve around the Earth. Phobos is so close to Mars, only 4,200 miles out, which is about one Mars diameter out, that the, about one Mars diameter out, 4,200 is exactly a Mars diameter. The next slide I'm going to show you what the numbers are, so I forget what it is. But in any case, it is so close to Mars that you could not see it from the surface of Mars if you were farther from the equator at about latitude 59 degrees north or south. So in the polar regions of Mars, Phobos is always hidden below the horizon. And if you were standing at the equator of Mars, where Phobos passes directly overhead, because both Phobos and Deimos have orbits that are exactly above the equator of Mars all the time. That's an important point, I'll come back to that. If you were standing at the equator of Mars, you would see Phobos moving in orbital motion around you. It's orbital motion, like most orbital motions in solar systems, from west to east. And so it would rise east to west. It would travel all the way from the horizon to the zenith in only 2 hours and 20 minutes, getting noticeably larger as it did so, because it would be coming noticeably closer to you. And, of course, going through something like a quarter of a cycle of phases. Not an entire quarter, because it is so close to Mars that you've got to worry about perspective, and it would be considerably less than a quarter of its entire orbit that you've seen. But it's going through a fair portion of a quarter of a cycle of phases. Then in another 2.5 hours, Phobos moves to the overhead point down to the east horizon where it's set. And then it repeats the entire thing again later that night and half again before the sunrise. And Phobos, although it is very tiny, we know now its size. We did not know at the time when all we have is pictures like this. But we know now that its size is about 15 miles in diameter. And I have to say about it because it's not spherical, as you'll see. But although it is so tiny, it's so close to Mars, that at its closest, directly overhead it seems in the equator, it would appear half as big in the Martian sky as our moon does from the Earth. So you would definitely see it, not as a dot of light, but as a well-defined disk in the sky. Phobos always faces the same side towards Mars, so does Deimos, in the same way as our moon does towards the Earth. And when you see the shape of it, you'll be able to understand why that is. Deimos is far enough away from Mars that it would appear as a dot of light to the naked eye. You would not be able to see the disk. You'll be the brightest star in the Martian sky, a star-like object. You'll be even brighter than the Earth, but it would not show a disk to the naked eye, although even a pair of binoculars would even show some detail on it, and with a telescope you'd be able to see all kinds of stuff. Deimos would rise in the east, because it is far enough out that Mars is rotating a little bit faster than it revolves, and it would slowly move up through the sky, remaining visible, as I said, above the horizon for 2.5 Martian days, day and night, before it finally sets. And then it would remain below the horizon day and night for 2.5 Martian days before it rose again. Deimos is far enough out that it would be visible from all over Mars, even the polar regions. So, we knew those things, and we knew very little else. Nevertheless, despite our ignorance about these moons, and despite how tiny they are, they already managed to achieve, even before we knew anything about them from spacecraft, at least two bodies of mythology associated with them, one of which we already mentioned. And that is the notion that somehow Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, knew about the moons of Mars 120 years before his and Apollo discovered them. Over there on the right, you see the real moons of Mars and their label Hall, because he's the one that discovered them, and their distances from the center of Mars are 1.37 and 3.46 Mars radii. In Gulliver's Travels, you will find in the section about Gulliver's visit to the flying island of Walcuta, which happens to be an exceedingly insulting expression in Spanish. That whole thing in the midst of the flying island of Locutia, where there were astronomers who knew things way above anybody, anything that was going on in Europe at the time, Gulliver discovered that, Gulliver found that the Locutian astronomers had discovered two moons of Mars. And their positions were 3 and 5 Mars radii out. So you will note that they are not, contrary to what you will often read, they are not at the right position. In fact, the inner moon is located about the position of the outer moon, really. And that is quite significant because the most noticeable thing about the moons of Mars is that Phobos is so very close to the planet that it does revolve around it less than a Martian day. And surely, if Swift knew anything about the real moons of Mars, he would have made a special note of that, just the way we do, talking about them now that we know about them. The reason that they are there is that Swift tapped into an old literary tradition that goes back at least to Kepler that Mars ought to have two moons. Johannes Kepler was one of the great founders of the science of astronomy, but he was also a thoroughgoing mystic. In those days, this is the distinction between science and pseudoscience was not anything like as clear as it, I guess I have to say, ought to be today. Whether it is today is definitely debatable. And Kepler was very much into numerical mysticism, forever trying to find numerical relationships among things which probably weren't related, and probably should have known had no reason to be related, although maybe this is just hindsight speaking. You gotta try these things out before you find out whether or not they work. And indeed, the valuable work that Kepler did is so thoroughly buried among all this garbage that he published ceaselessly that we owe a considerable debt to Sir Isaac Newton, a little while after Kepler, for taking the time and trouble to read through all this junk and pull out the relatively small proportion of it that actually turned out to be useful. Not that Newton himself didn't think it would all be in that way a little later on, but that's another story for another time. In any case, Kepler reasoned, if that's the word for it, as follows. Earth has got one moon, right? Jupiter had 4, and then Mars, right? And then Jupiter had 4, so far as anybody knew at the time. They had been discovered by Galileo. Saturn, at that time, was thought to have 8. And beyond that, there didn't know any planets. And so Kepler said, obviously, there should be a progression here. Well, it was obvious to Kepler, I'm sure it's obvious to me, that there ought to be a progression here, so Mars ought to have 2 moons. Well, of course, the whole thing is completely fallacious. For one thing, Jupiter does not have 4 moons. It has at least 13, maybe 14. Saturn does not have 8 moons. It has 9 for sure, maybe as many as 11. But it's even worse than that because most of the 8 moons that Saturn was thought to have in Kepler's time were in fact reflections of Saturn, the objects of primitive telescopes they had in those days. And the actual number of determining moons that existed then, the ones that really existed were actually known at the time, was something in the order of 3 or 4. But, you know, firstly, it wasn't the ones that didn't exist. There would be end up knowing others that did, because not as distinguished telescopes then. So numerical progression does not exist, and anyway, there's no reason why it should. But as a result of this reason, fallacious though it may have been, the idea got started, and was just sort of kicking around the fun notion to play with, that Mars ought to have 2 moons. And there are many literary sources from that time, most of which have been long since forgotten. They were not, you know, as good as John Swift. So there are no only stories in literature in which you read about Mars having 2 moons, which is a standard science fiction kind of notion in those days. Probably the only other one that you're likely to have heard of is Micromegas by Voltaire, and he also talked about Mars as having 2 moons. Swift and Voltaire are the names that have been given to the 2 biggest craters on Deimos, and Hall is the name given to the 2nd biggest crater on Phobos, the biggest being named Sidney, which was the main name of Hall's wife. And the reason for that is that Hall was finally trying to discover the moons of Mars, and he may have even been stimulated by this old literary tradition that Mars ought to have moons. He said afterwards something to the effect, and it is on record, we don't know if that was his motivation, but it is on record, he said afterwards that the reason that he looked for them was he got sick and tired of reading all the astronomy textbooks and Mars had no moons. But for whatever reason, he was trying and trying, and finally was about to give up, and his wife prevailed on him to try one more night. And it was that night that he discovered Deimos, the outer of the 2 moons. And a few nights later, while trying to find Deimos again and get his orbit, he discovered Phobos as well. And he said, in fact, at first he thought Mars might have several inner moons. And he just couldn't believe he had seen Phobos on one side of Mars, and a few hours later, he said, okay, Mars, so it's just moving so fast. So that's the story about Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's travels and the whole bit. It's a sheer coincidence. There's nothing more to it than that. And as you see from this diagrams, Swift did not, in fact, know anything about the real moon. He had them in the wrong place. The other myth is one that was popularized a few years ago by the highly respected Soviet astrophysicist Yosef Shklovsky. And the only reason most people have heard about it is that Shklovsky wrote a book in Russian, which was translated into English with the addition of considerable new material of his own by a then unknown young American astronomer named Carl Sagan. And the book is called Intelligent Life in the Universe by Shklovsky and Sagan. It is still in print. There are portions of it that are obsolete, but not a whole lot, and I still highly recommend it to any of you who would like to read a really fine book on modern astrophysics, which it does a good job of summarizing in one volume, a lot more readable than the average textbook. But Shklovsky has suggested that the moons of Mars might be artificial, and might in fact look something like this. This is not his idea. This is a design for a space colony in a spherical geometry, and this particular geometry is due more or less to the originator of the space colonization concept in its modern form, Gerard O'Neill. O'Neill's concept came considerably after Shklovsky's, and ironically, the big complaint that people gave about Shklovsky's idea was that such a thing was technologically impossible. You could build an artificial structure that size with any conceivable future technology. A few years later, in 1969, what does O'Neill do? Come along and show that you can do with present-day technology, essentially. Space shuttle technology anyway, just a few years down the pipe. What happened was this. 1943, 42, something like that, an American astronomer named Joseph Sharpless had made observations which seemed to show that Phobos was very, very slowly spiraling in towards Mars as though it was being slowed down by atmospheric friction in the same way as, for example, Skylight is being slowed down right now. And many of you are probably aware that there's a great deal of worry that Skylight may enter the Earth's atmosphere and not completely burn out and cease to make it to the Earth's surface before the space shuttle was able to get up there fast and rockets wouldn't get out to a higher orbit again. I hate to add the danger of any human being being hit by a piece of Skylab is exceedingly remote, and if somebody will be kind enough to calculate the target point, if indeed we're not able to save by the shuttle, and will pay my airfare, I will cheerfully go and stand there because it will be the most magnificent meteor spectacle you can possibly imagine, and I would love to see it. I would love even more if I were to see Skylab saved, not because it's any great danger, but because it's $2.5 billion investment. It did wonderful things during the period of the program itself, but and did far more effect than we ever expected. However, there it is sitting up there, perfectly usable space station, and now we've got the shuttle, we wouldn't expect to be able to re-inhabit it. So it seems a shame to lose that if there's any way we can save it. Well, in any case, the reason the satellite does such a thing is that here it is orbiting around the planet, and if there's a little bit of air friction, that air friction will tend to slow it down, and that brings it into a slightly closer orbit where the air isn't that much denser. No, air gets denser and denser as you go towards the planetary surface, and so you have still more air friction, it snowballs, and eventually the planet enters again, the satellite enters the atmosphere, and at least partially burns up. Sharpless made observations that seemed to show that Phobos was slowing down this way, and the problem with that is that Phobos is awfully far out from Mars. Skylab was only 170 miles out, and Skylab only weighs 100 tons. Phobos weighs a heck of a lot more than 100 tons, and it's a heck of a lot farther out. And so the question was, how could the very, very thin atmosphere, far better than so-called vacuum inside a radio tube, which is all Mars could possibly have out there at that height, be slowing down Phobos? And in fact, to this day, the answer is not really known so far as I've been able to tell. Apparently, Sharpless's observations were valid, and Phobos really is doing this, and within the next couple of hundred millions of years, Phobos is going to not spiral into the atmosphere and burn up. Phobos is too big to do that. Phobos instead will be torn apart by Mars' tidal forces, and Mars will end up with a ring, not a spectacular Saturn, but a ring nonetheless. Indeed, that may be the origin of the ring of Saturn. There may have been a moon very slowly moved into Saturn. In this case, it would not be atmospheric, which would be another reasonably gravitational effect of the other moons and the sun on it. And it got to a certain distance from Saturn, where Saturn's tidal force would tear it apart, and indeed, we can calculate where that distance would be. It's right where the Seagull is today. Broke up, and maybe what you would expect, we don't know the other possibilities. Well, in any case, getting back to Phobos, Shklovsky suggested that the only way that an object that big, and of course we didn't know the size, but it was obviously brightness, so it had to be something of the order of 10 miles across, something like that. The only way that something that big could be slowed down by air that thin would be if its density was extremely low. problem. You know, I mentioned last night in answer to a question from this gentleman that the moon outwardly could not be hollow. A body that is several thousand miles in diameter cannot possibly be hollow because its own gravity would collapse. That is not true for something only 10 miles across. That's small enough, therefore has a weak enough gravity that if you could build something that big to hollow, it'll stay that big. But what in nature would create a perfectly hollow moon? And so Chomsky said, it is possible that the moons of Mars, or at least both of them, are artificial bodies, that they were constructed by Martians, presumably, and that it is in orbit around Mars, whereas the Martians are now extinct, but it's still there, or perhaps they're still using it. It was a wonderful idea, and then wrong. But it got a great deal of publicity as a result of that book, which has been deservedly widely read. And so I'm forever having to talk about it, so I wanted to mention it. I'm forever having to have questions about it, so I want to talk about it now. I can prove that it's wrong, because I know that Mrs. Klaus didn't. But the reasonable speculation at the time he made it is not a reasonable speculation now. In the first place, we now know that it could be a phobos, because both Viking orbiters have flown close enough to it that they were affected by its weak gravity. Only a few tens of miles away from it. And I will show you the incredible close-up pictures that they took as a result of doing that, of both Phobos and Deimos. So we know its density, and its density is not low enough to be hollow. Its density is respectable 2 grams per cubic centimeter. That is low for a rock, and thereby makes an interesting tale all by itself, but it sure ain't hollow. Even before that, we were able to prove that it was not hollow when we got the first close-up pictures of it from Mariner 9, which showed that it was covered with craters. At least one of which, simply the biggest of all, is so big that it is rather difficult to understand how Phobos managed to avoid being broken apart by the impact, even though it's solid. And if it had been hollow, in the first place, you would have seen the inside of your body as a crater. And in the second place, the sinking impact particularly, and probably the hollow impact as well, would have simply shattered like an eggshell. So it is not hollow. But the idea of building something of that size is, in fact, reasonable. And as I mentioned, find out more about it if you're willing to go down to Oakland and hear my space colonization lecture. It is a reasonable sort of thing for us to do with present-day technology. There are a lot of good reasons for doing it. It seems to hold a great deal of promise for solving a number of our material problems, starting with the energy crisis. And it is not impossible that space colony might end up with some sort of spherical geometry and might even end up being about the size of Phobos. This particular artist's conception is, in fact, for a science already out of it, too small. A sphere that's that small would have to rotate so fast to provide enough artificial gravity to make human beings feel at home that it would be like living in a merry-go-round, and all those cute little semicircular canals in your inner ear would give you all kinds of problems every time you try to walk around inside it. But for a somewhat bigger one, this thing is only about a third mile across, for a somewhat bigger one, the size of Phobos, the spherical geometry is an entirely reasonable sort of thing to do. Well, so much for the myths about the moons of Mars, and that was all we had to subsist on, those in our knowledge of their orbits and their appearance to Mars, for a long time. But in the last few years, that situation has changed very dramatically, and for the remainder of the lecture, I'm going to tell you what they're really like. Here is the first picture ever taken of either of them. That was made by Mariner 7 in 1969. Mariner 7 simply flew past Mars and going to orbit around it, so we didn't try to land on it. And sent back pictures, about 200 of them, as it went by. Mariner 7 made a number of important discoveries about Mars itself. For example, that every winter the air freezes solid and falls on the ground around the pole. And the snow caps that we had been seeing, the winter snow caps that we had been seeing from the Earth, were not made of nice, friendly, frozen water, as we had thinking up to that point. They were made of frozen Martian air, which is to say frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice. Because Martian air is 95% carbon dioxide. But incidentally, the polar caps are more complicated than that. The residual caps that are making ice in summer, and those are frozen water and so on. But the big winter caps are frozen carbon dioxide. At least those are partly frozen water. It's even more complicated than that. Somebody I can come back and tell you that and give you that lecture too. In any case, one of the pictures showed this little dot. All the pictures show a whole lot of dots, but those were put on the inside of the television camera deliberately so that they could look at them and make sure that no geometric distortion had happened to the pictures as they were transmitted back across all those millions of miles of space. There is an extra dot, though, that nature put there, and you know that a television camera is made up of a whole lot of little individual dots. If you blow up that particular portion of it, what you get is this, and that is Phobos, seen in silhouette against the surface of Mars over 4,000 miles below. Of course, it's not a very clear picture. The resolution, which is to say the fineness of detail that you can see, is pretty lousy. But already, this picture gave us three shots about Phobos. Number one, he was a great deal larger than anybody had realized. Number two, the reason for that is that it is the blackest object that was known at the time in solar system. Later it turned out that Amos and quite a lot of other objects were black as well, and shortly I'll tell you why. The reason that the blackness has to do with the interaction of the size is this. If all you have is the brightness of some little tiny dot of light, a satellite or an asteroid or whatever, you can estimate its size crudely by saying, well, how big has got to be to reflect that much sunlight to appear that bright? Or in the case of the name of that thing. But you've got to make an assumption before you can do this. You've got to make an assumption about its albedo, which is to say, how much of the sunlight that hits it can reflect. Think about it for a minute. If you have an object of a particular brightness and it's made of very white material, for example, snow, obviously it's going to be a great deal smaller than an object of the same brightness that's made of something that's cold black, right? The albedo of an object expresses whether it is white or black or some gray in between, or if it's colored, it needs to reflect how much expresses how much of the light that it reflects. And the albedo of photons turns out to be only 2%. That is blacker than coal, blacker than slate, blacker than obsidian, blacker than any common rock on the Earth. And there was a great deal of questions to why it could be that way. The third shock is that it's not spherical. I think you can see even from this picture, it's not even approximately round. Every other astronomical body that we ever see, stars, planets, moons, even our moon, if you know where we think were round, and this was the very first one that was not. That was a shock, not because it was unexpected, but just because it was, you know, knowing that it could happen, which we did beforehand is one thing, and actually seeing it is something else. I will try to explain those to you one at a time. Well, the size I've already explained, the reason we underestimated the size is we didn't know how black it is. So I'll try to explain first the blackness and then the non-spherical shape. First, let's show you some better pictures. This is the historic first picture of Phobos ever taken. Here is a much better one, made in 1971 by Mariner 9. That crosshatch pattern behind it is an artifact of the computer processing, which was used to try to get as much detail out of the picture as possible. But what you are seeing down there, over 4,000 miles behind Phobos, is the great Martian dust storm of 1971, which covered the entire planet with veils of swirling dust 30 miles high in the atmosphere, driven by winds that exceeded 300 miles an hour. We thought at the time that those winds were all over the planet. Now, in the Viking Orca investigation, it wasn't so they're only in certain places where the dust is raised and then it is carried by atmospheric circulation all over the planet. Nevertheless, there's 300 mile an hour winds going on down there in that dust storm. Here is an even better silhouette picture of Phobos against the Martian surface that was taken by Viking Orbiter 1 about a year ago. And you can see, again, that it has a very non-spherical shape. Roughly, its shape is that of an ellipsoid. An ellipse is the shape that you get. Well, the easiest way to explain to you what it is the shape that you get if you take a circle and you turn it, you know, and then look at it from the side. I'm not saying this is actually a circular object, you can turn and look at it from the side, but I am saying it has that same shape. An ellipse is often incorrectly referred to in certain orbits, because orbits can be elliptical. Often incorrectly described in news reports as A-shaped. An A-shaped orbit is a physical impossibility. An A, as you know, if you have looked at the egg display out there in the corridor, if you walk in here to the lecture hall, is shaped differently at the two ends, right? It's more pointed one end to the other end. Duck eggs can be polar or not, and so you're wanting to lift the shape of a duck egg, but that gets a bit of a foul comparison. In any case, the easiest way to, the easiest way to describe what an ellipse is just to take a hula hoop and turn it on edge, or of course it is, it's elliptical, as we know. Well, in any case, let's see if you're still awake, fair enough. Ellipse, tickle, get it covered. The shape of Phobos is very definitely non-spherical. Deimos has the same kind of shape, and there seem to be two possibilities. That's not Phobos, that's a moon rock. it's about 5 inches long. There seem to be two possibilities as to what it could be made of that would make it as dark as it turned out to be. You've seen in the picture now with shape, it also has a very, very black object. Number one, it might be made of basalt. Now, those of you who are here for the Monday night lecture know all about basalt. You know that it is a dark black lava, which is common on all the inner planets. You have it on the moon, 2 million square miles of it. The dark spots that form the base of the man on the moon, the so-called Mario on the moon, are made of basalt. The ocean floors of the Earth are made of basalt. So is the southern third of Io, so are the Hudson Palisades and all kinds of other places. Very common lava on the Earth. It is common on the moon. It is common on Mercury. Probably common on Venus. Certainly a couple places where you can see the solid rock on Venus, and you have it on Mars as well. So it would be too surprising to find the salt as the constituent of as what Phobos is made of. There are meteorites that are made of basalt. However, if Phobos is in fact made of basalt, then we have learned some things about its origin. We talked about the origin of our moon last night. Now I want to talk about the origin of moons and Mars. There seem to be at least two possibilities. One, that they form more or less where they are now, around the orbit around Mars. Two, that once upon a time they were independent bodies in orbit around the Sun by themselves, and something this small you would not call a planet, you would call an asteroid, and that they had been captured by Mars' gravity at some time in the distant past. The asteroid is a general name that you give for any small body that orbits the Sun, and nobody has really come up with an official dividing line as to where planets stop and asteroids start. You know, there's some size range below which you start talking, stop talking planets, stop talking an asteroid. Most of the asteroids, and all the big ones, that are most of the big ones, depending on what you decide to call Tyrus, for that matter, Pluto, are in the asteroid belt, which is a region of debris orbiting around the Sun in between Mars and Jupiter. The asteroid belt is of uncertain origin itself. We know that most of the asteroids are fragments of originally bigger bodies. We know that in two different ways. Number one, we get meteorites on Earth. Those come from the asteroid belt. We can tell that by studying their orbit. So we have actual fragments of asteroids, and that's how we know some asteroids are made of basalt, because we've got these basaltic meteorites. And we can study how long they've been in space, and they have by the radioactivity system of cosmic radiation, and they have not been in space for unprotected exposure to cosmic radiation for anything like the whole history of the solar system. Number two, we can study the distribution of sizes of the asteroids. How many are there this size planet, how many are there this smaller size planet, and so on down. And that turns out to be the characteristic distribution, characteristic mathematical distribution of sizes that you get in a population of collision fragments. We know from laboratory experiments that if you take two rocks and bang together real hard, they break up into pieces. Well, there's a well-defined sequence of how many fragments of each size you get. And if you have a lot of those fragments, it turns out you get a population distribution such as you see in the asteroid belt, with the exception that there are too many of the very large asteroids. So what's apparently happened is these very big asteroids, out there 300 miles, 500 miles across, a few of them, maybe a dozen of them, are the lucky survivors. They have managed to escape being broken up. Now all the others are fragments of originally larger bodies. We can also prove from studying the asteroids, from studying the meteorites, that the parent bodies of these fragments were never bigger than a few hundred miles across. The old idea that all of the asteroids are the remnants of the breakup of one single planet is dead. You can shoot it down from that fact, and you can also shoot it down from the fact that different asteroids, both studied spectroscopically from Earth and studied in the laboratory for meteorites, which are fragments of asteroids on Earth, you find rock types. There are about 50 different kinds of meteorites, and at least 20 different kinds of asteroids, and definitely more than that. We can't study them out there as well as we can study rocks in front of the table down here. Those include rock types which are in the water, which do not possibly have both come out of the same planet. And here's why. Some of you have already heard this before because I mentioned an earlier lecture in the series, but I'll go over it quickly. When the Earth, for example, formed 4.5 million years ago, during or immediately after its formation, it melted entirely. And when it melted, it differentiated. What that means is the various kinds of material that made it up, various types of rock and metal, separated out by weight. The heaviest stuff fell at the center, formed the iron core of the Earth. The lightest rocks floated up to the surface and formed the crust of the Earth. Other rocks formed shells, successively heavier and heavier down between the crust and core. And so you had a structure like the skin of an onion. Okay, that process is called gravitational differentiation. The Earth did it, the Moon did it, Mars did it, Mercury did it, Venus apparently did it. So the standard sort of thing for bodies near the solar system. You do not expect very small objects to have gravitationally differentiated, however. And the reason for that is that if you have a small body and then a larger body made of the same stuff, the smaller body, all else being equal, will be cooler on the inside. The heat that keeps a planet hot inside, for example, keeps the Earth almost molten through most of its body, some parts of it actually are molten, for example, the outer core, that heat is produced by the very slow decay of radioactive elements, which are present as trace impurities. It is not, by the way, the case, as geologists thought 50 years ago, the reason the Earth is not inside is that it was torn out of the sun, it was very hot then, and it hasn't had a chance to cool off. The first place, the Earth was not torn out of the sun, and the second place, it has had a chance to cool off 200 times over during the winter. So the reason the Earth is hot inside is something in there is keeping it hot, and what's keeping it hot is radioactive decay. Okay, now consider two bodies, one of which is twice the size of the other. Okay, it's called Bonnie and Clyde. Clyde is the big one, Bonnie is the little one. Bonnie is half the size of Clyde. So the amount of volume that Bonnie has, in other words, the number of radioactive atoms that Bonnie has inside, is not half that of Clyde, it's 1/8. The volume of a sphere goes up or goes down as the cube of the diameter, not as the diameter. Okay? You have to take the radius of the diameter and multiply it by itself and multiply it by itself again. So a body that is half the size of another one has 1/8 the interior volume, therefore 1/8 the number of radioactive atoms generated heat. How is the heat lost? Why do things get hotter and hotter and hotter and stuff? Answer, the heat is radiated out into space from the surface of the planet. And Bonnie's surface area is 1/4 that of Clyde's. Okay? The surface area of a sphere goes up or goes down only a square of the diameter. So, if you have two bodies, which are generating their own heat internally and radiating out into space from the surface, then the smaller one has, if it's only half the size of the bigger one, has only 1/8 as much radioactive material to generate heat in the first place, but just 1/4 the surface area to radiate out of space. In other words, the ratio of the surface area by which you radiate it out of space to the amount of heat generated in the first place goes down as the body gets smaller. So you expect a small object to be cooler inside the big object. And this is familiar in all kinds of other situations. This is the reason why if you have a sound device in the form of cubes, it melts much faster than if you have a sound device in the form of a single block, right? Separated out of these small bodies, and the heat from the outside, here's a matter of warming them up and cooling them down, can get at them very much more readily. This is the reason why there are no really small mammals in the Arctic. You don't have the shrews, the really tiny mammals, that dominate mammal populations everywhere else in the Earth. The smallest you get are, lemmings, I suppose, and then snowshoe there. And the reason for that is these are objects which are generating their own heat internally, and it is to their advantage to be large. And so you got polar bears in the Arctic because you don't have any shrews. Okay, so for the same reason, you expect planets to get, as they get smaller and smaller, they're made of the same stuff, to get cooler and cooler on the inside. So there's going to be some diameter below which you do not expect a planetary body to have melted and therefore differentiated. Okay? Now, once upon a time, we thought that diameter was big enough that our moon was not affected by the sun bodies to have melted and differentiated. It has, however. We landed on the moon, the very first instrument which could determine what the moon was made of, that was on the unmanned spacecraft Surveyor 5, and it discovered that it was sitting on a piece of basalt on the moon of Mars. Basalt can be produced only on a planet that has melted and differentiated. Basalt is necessarily the product of differentiation. On the other hand, we can calculate what a planet would be like if it never melted and differentiated, what the rock would be made of. If you could take the whole Earth, for example, or take a giant egg beater to it and mix it all back together, and then let the result solidify, what would you get? What you would get is a kind of rock that is unlike any that has ever been found on the Earth or the Moon, but is like a particular class of meteorite called carbonaceous chondrite. And carbonaceous chondrites are very interesting because they are undifferentiated matter. They tell us what all the terrestrial planets must be more or less like at the very beginning of solar system history when the planets had just formed or were still in the process of forming before they had a chance to do this thing about melting differentiation. Well, the point is that there are meteorites which are undifferentiated, the carbonaceous chondrites, and yet there are also meteorites of the product of differentiation. For example, there are basaltic ones, there are ones that are made of the northside, which is the other major rock on the moon, and is also the product of differentiation. There are ones that are just about pure metal, as though they had come from the metallic core of the sun body and so forth. There is no way that all of those could have come from a single object. We have, after the shock of discovering the moon was in fact differentiated, we have redone our thinking a little bit and concluded that in order to be differentiated, a body were not differentiated or be undifferentiated, a body can be no more than a few hundred miles across. And indeed, when we look at the majority of the asteroids, especially those in the outer part of the asteroid belt, especially the smaller ones, we've discovered in recent years that they are of undifferentiated composition, that they have the same spectra as this class of meteorite that we call carbonaceous chondrite. So, to conclude all of this and bring it back into what it has to do with Phobos and Deimos, if Phobos and Deimos were made of this rock called basalt, then they must once have been part of a larger body. Perhaps they were both part of the same larger body, or perhaps they were part of a different larger body, but there is no way they could be of basaltic composition, which is to say there is no way they could be made of a differentiated rock, if they were always as small as they are now. On the other hand, carbonaceous chondrites are also very dark. Here is a carbonaceous chondrite. You can see it is quite a black-looking object, and the reason for that comes from the name carbonaceous. They're chock full of carbon, both in the form of the element carbon, which you know is black, and, interestingly enough, in the form of organic substances. By that, I do not mean substances produced by living things. Don't get excited about these for the wrong reason. They were produced by non-living processes, but they are the same kinds of chemicals that living things are made of. And in fact, in carbonaceous chondritic meteorite, we have found organic chemicals all the way up to the level of complexity of amino acids, which is the building blocks of proteins. And that is a tremendously exciting finding, because it means that even before the planets formed, you had these organic substances in the solar system, and those are the sort of things that eventually gave rise to life here on the Earth. So that increases the probability that life is common throughout the universe. If you had so much of this stuff that was the building blocks of life even before there were planets on the Earth, let alone having to wait until after planets are formed, getting exactly the right environment on planets and so forth and so on, it increases the probability that elsewhere in the universe they were able to get together and form living things. If Phobos and Deimos were carbonaceous chondritic composition, then number one, they were never very much larger than they are now, and number two, the chances are they are captured asteroids. And the reason for that is that according to calculations that were made by John Lewis, particularly at MIT, who has done the most extensive work on the theory of what objects in the solar system at different distances from the sun, which were forming under the influence of different temperatures, ought to be made of, material of strictly carbonaceous chondritic composition could not form closer to the sun than about the middle of the asteroid belt. So what I said is, you know, if you mix the Earth back together, you may have noticed I said you would get something with approximately carbonaceous chondrite, but not exactly. For a true carbonaceous chondrite, unless one is totally wrong, you've got to go to the outer half of the asteroid belt. And it is very interesting, and that was significant, that when you do spectroscopic studies of what asteroids are made of, most of those in the outer part of the asteroid belt are carbonaceous chondrite. Most of those in the inner part are not. They're either other kinds of chondrite, or they are made, of course, we have sprinkling in all parts of the asteroid belt of fragments of once differentiated bodies, basaltic kinds of material, metallic kinds of material, anorthosite, etc., etc. So, we would like to find out what these objects are made of for reasons that go far beyond sheer curiosity as to what they're made of, sheer geochemical questions. If you can find out what they are made of, then you have a powerful clue as to their origin and their past history. We have found out what they are made of from the Viking investigation. There are several lines of evidence. First of all, here is a Viking Orbiter 1 picture of Deimos. That is a color photograph. But you don't see any color. Or where you do see color, for example, there is a faint yellowish tinge over there and a faint bluish tinge there, it is entirely an artifact of computer processing to do this 100% color. And yet, you observe that there are places on Deimos and Phobos, especially Deimos, which are brighter, which have higher albedo than other places. There are several reasons why a body might have places with higher albedo than other places. The most obvious reason is it's made of different rock, right? If so, then the body is differentiated by definition. On the other hand, if you take any rock and you grind it up into a powder, for example, by a meteorite impact, it will be lighter in albedo than if you don't, than if you leave it behind as solid rock. That is the reason why the rays on the moon, the bright streaks you find around many recent craters, are brighter than the rocks they're lying on, even though in many cases they're made of the same kind of rock. You grind up a rock and make it into a fine powder, and it becomes higher in albedo. The fact that the color of both Deimos and Phobos is the same everywhere, and it is uniform, monotonous gray, even though the albedo varies from place to place. The color of the high albedo beams, the same as the color of the low albedo beams, implies that it's all the same kind of rock. In other words, that these bodies are not differentiated. There is, however, an even better test, or the second line of evidence, which is they have both been observed in infrared wavelength from the surface of Mars, which is near infrared, not the thermal infrared that is emitted by objects that are glowing by their own heat, but near infrared, and it turns out that in the near infrared wavelength band, there are particular wavelengths which are reflected very strongly by the salt and not by carbon-based time lines. And these observations are consistent with both Deimos and Phobos being carbon-based concentrated compositions. But the most direct evidence came in these incredible kamikaze missions in which the two orbiters flew so terribly close to both moons and yet did not crash into them. A very, very difficult thing to do. Viking was well over a year old before the mission controllers felt that they had the courage to try such a thing and felt they knew enough about Mars' gravitational field to try such a thing. But successively, one approach after another, closer and closer and closer, one orbiter after another, one moon after another, were made. And the result of that is that the orbiters have been affected strongly enough by the moon's gravity that we can find out how heavy the two moons are, and therefore just their size, of course, we get their density. Carbonaceous concentrated material is a good deal lower in density, a good deal less heavy per cubic inch than is the solid material, and these have exactly the densities that you expect of carbonaceous concentrate. However, their densities are not the same. The density of Deimos, I think the density of Deimos is a little bit less than that of Phobos, I forget. In any case, they are different, that's the important thing. And there are, in fact, different kinds of carbonaceous concentrate, type 1, type 2, and type 3, which differ from one another in the exact amount of carbonaceous material they've got, in how much water they have particularly. And the one that has the most amount of water has 50% more than the one that has the least amount. All of them have large amounts of water in them, unlike, for example, our own moon, which, as I pointed out over the last two lectures, is rather unusual in the universe in having no water whatsoever, despite the fact that water is the commonest chemical compound in the entire universe. Well, apparently, Deimos and Phobos are different kinds of carbonaceous concentrate. And so the summary of what we've learned about their composition, and therefore what we've learned about their history, is, number one, that neither of them was ever very much larger than they are now, and number two, they are not the result of the breakup of a single object. And, of course, number three, both of them are almost certainly, unless John Lewis is dead wrong, in which case it's hard to explain the relative compositions in the half of the asteroid belt, they are almost certainly captured asteroids. That is a very strange finding, because of their orbit. If a body is captured by the gravity of another object in an orbit around it, which is a very, very difficult thing to do in the first place, it requires very special circumstances, or it can't happen at all. But if it is captured, in general, you expect its orbit to be more or less random. In other words, you don't expect a perfectly circular orbit, you expect some sort of elliptical orbit. And you certainly don't expect an orbit that has anything particularly to do with the equator of the planet that you're revolving around. You expect it in general to be inclined with respect to that equator. So it's rather difficult to understand why it is that both moons of Mars have orbits which are perfectly circular and always remain directly above the point, directly above Mars' equator. But such appears to be the case. This has relevance to the question of the origin of other planetary satellites. For example, Jupiter has a lot of small moons revolving around it, in addition to the four big ones. The outer eight of those small moons, at least, have often been regarded as being of asteroidal origin. Jupiter is, after all, sitting on the other side of the asteroid belt from Mars, so that's not too ridiculous. And they do indeed have orbits which, in general, are inclined highly to Jupiter, to Jupiter's equatorial plane, and which are not at all perfectly circular. In fact, half of them revolve around Jupiter in one direction, half revolve around Jupiter in the other direction. So you've got a completely random set of orbits there. But Jupiter also has, closest of all of its moons, even closest to it than the four big ones, all of which have orbits that are nicely circular, right above the plane of the equator, and that usually taken as an indication that they formed out of the same big rotating cloud of gas that Jupiter itself did. But Jupiter has, closest of all to it, even closest to it than the four big ones,
a little moon named Amalthea. And Amalthea has a small spot, it's like the outer moon, so you might think it's a captured asteroid, and if you believe that it forms along with the four big ones, you've got the problem explaining why it's so tiny. But it has a perfectly circular orbit, which is perfectly in the plane of Jupiter's equator. And that would be taken as evidence against it being a captured asteroid, were it not for the fact that we know about Phobos and Deimos, which according to composition are probably captured asteroids, and yet which have orbits that are the same way. One of the things that the Voyagers are going to do if they fly past Jupiter next year is take detailed pictures of all four of the big moons, but also of Amalthea. And it's going to be very interesting to find out whether Amalthea looks anything like Phobos and Deimos. Probably asteroids in general look like Phobos and Deimos, including the fact they're covered with all impact craters. As I mentioned, we believe that most of the asteroids are collision fragments, and for every case where there's a collision violent enough to break them apart, there must be a lot of cases where there's a collision of a little object with a much bigger asteroid, which is why the crater doesn't actually knock it apart. Now, let's get on to the question of the shape. Sorry about that, let's not get on to the question of the shape. I want to say a little bit more about space colonization for those of you who have heard about it particularly. The original ideas for building space colonies were to make them out of lunar material. And in fact, the key to making the whole space colonization concept economically reasonable is not using material from the Earth, using material from a low gravity environment such as the moon. It is much easier to land on and take off from the moon than it is to land on and take off from the Earth. That fact was obscured during Apollo because we had to do both, so you have to put the words in both worlds. So if you think about it for a minute, to get off of the Earth through our very, very heavy gravity, you needed that enormous tall Saturn V rocket. To land on and take off from the moon, all you needed was a little bitty lunar module, which was so tiny and had a thrust that was so gentle that the astronauts didn't even have couches to sit in. They landed and took off standing up. They were thoroughly strapped in, so they didn't even have to sit down because the thrust was so gentle. So the whole key is going to the moon and staying there for extended periods of time, building a lunar mining base, and then sending the lunar material up into space where it can be processed using solar energy, which is very freely abundant in space, and make a space colony out of that, and make things like the solar energy collecting satellites, which would pay for the whole space colonization scheme, and beam down the energy of the Earth with all the energy price for it in a totally non-polluting manner. We also produce ridiculously cheap energy, and so on and so forth. All wonderful ideas, but it's key to the idea of using low gravity environments. Well, the thing is that the moon is a good source for building, but it's not ideal. Here is the weight abundance, the relative weight abundances of the different kinds of atoms that make up typical lunar soil. This is Hyland soil from Apollo 13. Here is what you need for the space colony, which is called L5, after an early suggestion as to where it ought to be put, namely the fifth Lagrangian point of the Earth-Moon system, which is a point of gravitational balance. Turns out there are even better places than L5, so that's been dropped. Much of the stress of the L5 Society, which was formed to promote the whole idea, and was given that name before the L5 location was dropped. But nevertheless, you see that you can get oxygen from the moon. In fact, this is by weight. If you count it by number of atoms, two-thirds of the oxygen in the moon, two-thirds of the atoms in the moon are oxygen. And the same thing is true of the Earth, as a matter of fact. Two-thirds of the atoms that you're walking around on in the solid body of the Earth are oxygen atoms. And you have plenty of metal, aluminum in the Hyalinth, iron and titanium in the Maria. You have silicon to make glass and to make electronic components. You have lots of other good stuff. But what you don't have is, for example, hydrogen. So you can't make water from lunar materials. There is no water in the moon. Obviously, you need water. Human beings are going to be living there. So you have to carry at least your hydrogen up from the Earth. The oxygen you can get from the moon, the oxygen is by far the heaviest part of the water molecule, but you still do have to carry hydrogen. You don't have nitrogen, and although it's not shown here, you don't have carbon, and therefore you don't have the same, the organic chemicals that on Earth we synthesize out of petrochemicals. The point of all this is that the moon is nice for space colonies, nice for space manufacturing, but it's not ideal. Carbonaceous chondrites, on the other hand, have not only all these things you have in the moon, they also have lots of water, they have lots of nitrogen, hydrogen, and carbon, they have these organic substances. A typical carbonaceous chondrite is about as rich in organics as a typical oil shale, and they have everything. Of course they have everything. They are the bodies that the solar system solid objects formed out of. So naturally they've got everything. By definition they've got everything. So the latest idea is to skip the moon entirely and go
go directly to the asteroids. And maybe that argument would be possible, maybe not. Always been obvious in very first papers of space colonization that the ultimate desire was to be able to drop them and go to the asteroids. And the reason for this is because we made it a superior substance. Well, now it turns out that there are two bodies that we need to know more about carbonaceous chondrite than we know. And part of the problem is if you have one sitting on the Earth, you don't in general know where it came from. The importance of Phobos and Deimos is for the first time we have objects that are known to be a carbonaceous chondrite composition, and yet we know where they are. We have a pretty good idea about their history. And so that should enable us to find out more things about carbonaceous chondrite, which could well be important. The particular thing that is being discussed now, it's very controversial, and big arguments going on in space colonization circles about this, is the following. Here is a device called a mass driver, which originally was thought of, as you see it here, as a gadget that would send the lunar material from the surface of the moon into space. A mass driver is basically a giant doorbell. That is, most doorbells work by something called a funnel motion. You set up a magnetic field inside a coil of wire, which you know by simply running like you turn through the coil of wire. And that magnetic field has such a characteristic that when you turn it on, it causes a bar of metal placed down the center of the coil to move in this direction, in the direction down the axis of the coil. And you arrange it so there's a bell there for it to hit. Okay? In the case of a mass driver, what you have is not a coil, but a whole bunch of rings, so that's a detail. You set up a magnetic field that pulses through in such a way as to pick up a metallic box, which is full of lunar soil, and accelerate it continuously down the length of the mass driver until it finally got to the point where it's going fast enough to escape from the moon entirely and fly it off into space. You then capture your metal box, which is a valuable thing. You open the door at the end of it, at the very end of the process, let the soil go flying off into space, and you decelerate your box and use it again. Mass drivers are a theoretical kind of thing so far. The time that O'Neill originally suggested this, they were entirely theoretical. No such thing had ever been built. And in O'Neill's original paper of space colonization, which came out in 1974, he estimated that when mass drivers would finally go, all the technological development had been done, we might be able to get up to accelerations of 30 g's, 30 times the gravitational acceleration that you're feeling right here as you sit in your chair at the surface of the Earth. In order to get up to any sort of reasonable speed, that means the mass drivers would have had to be many miles long as you were seeing them here at the start of conception. Well, a mass driver has now been built. It was built literally over their Easter vacation last year by a bunch of MIT students working under Professor Henry Cole, who has a lengthy history of work with magnetic levitation, for example, for railroads in which you use magnetic fields to lift the train a little bit up off the track so you don't have as much friction, and then you go zipping off at some high speed with the car. Here is the world's first demonstration of that mass driver. There's one of the students holding the little box, which they elegantly refer to as the bucket. That's what would have the payload in it. And there you see all the coils, and here's the mass driver, and there's Professor Cole. This is at the Space Colonization Conference, third international one, which was held at Princeton University last year, which I was fortunate enough to be able to attend and take this picture. And this student-built model achieved an acceleration of 100 g's. They are now talking quite seriously about accelerations of thousands and even tens of thousands of gravity as being something that will be routinely achievable once this technology is worked out a little bit further. What that means is the mass driver can be made short enough. The higher the acceleration, the shorter you need it to get the payload up to a given speed. It can be made short enough that you can think in terms of carrying one on board a spacecraft. In other words, the mass driver is a propulsive device, not just a fixed ground-based installation for shooting lunar material up into space. And so the latest idea is, go out to an asteroid, probably it will be smaller than the Earth is seen here, fasten a mass driver or a mass driver to it, use the material of the asteroid itself as your, I can't say fuel, you just shoot it out the end, reaction mass. Yeah, these things are so primitive. It's really almost embarrassing to mention them to you. We'd always assume that whatever would replace the rocket would be some real high technology thing, you know, a laser drive or an ion drive or solar sails or something like that.
This is the thing right out of chapter 2 of all the elementary books on how rockets work, of the little man throwing the bricks off the sled and telling the dude to turn off and solve the floor in the other direction. But it turns out the little man, who has a magnetic field, can throw those bricks or anything else you want to throw away. Anything that you've got is usable as fuel for this. Anything you want to throw away, any kind of trash you've got. By the way, this is not creating navigation hazards. The front has to go back to the solar system. And you can get much higher velocities from this than from any rocket fuel, either currently existing or even theoretical the rocket chem as a product. So, you go out, you find yourself an asteroid which crosses the orbit of the Earth. And another important discovery in recent years from asteroid astronomy is that there are many more such bodies than we realize. There are probably hundreds of them, even thousands. You find one that is just made of what you want, and the very first Earth orbit crossing asteroid that is probably, although it's not certain yet, of asteroidal composition was discovered last week. It was named Ra Shalom, after the Egyptian god of the sun, Ra, and the Hebrew word for peace, Shalom, because it was discovered during the Camp David conference. And you say, all right, so, you may be hearing about Ra Shalom centuries after Camp David is ancient history of interest only to you especially. Go out, find yourself an Earth-crossing asteroid made of just the right stuff, having just the most desirable orbit. Fasten a mass driver or mass drivers to it. Use the material of the asteroid itself as your reaction mass. Throw away 70% of the mass of the asteroid in doing that, and pirate the remaining 30% into an orbit around the Earth, where you use it as a supply dump, which would have enough material to be capable of building approximately 1 million space colonies, each big enough to house several million people. Right now, studies are going on to see whether or not this is, in fact, as it currently appears, technologically feasible with essentially present-day technology, how our present-day was 10 years ago. Something like that.
Didn't want to hear the lectures that if a body crosses
in
orbit of another body, there's only
a
probability of several million years to the body.
Several hundred million years. Yeah, so see, we're not doing anything ecologically bad here. These are bodies that are going to hit the Earth anyway within a couple hundred million years. I mean closer to the sun, yeah. If they cross the orbit in the two-dimensional sense, draw a map of solar system on a piece of paper, chances are they don't cross in the three-dimensional sense, they cross the way a bridge crosses the highway. But these small bodies, they are subject to planetary and solar perturbation, and sooner or later they're going to hit the Earth. You survive somewhat longer if you have a high inclination orbit, but that only postpones the inevitable.
How many
Well, this picture is a little big, but if you imagine cutting that down to a hint, you've got the general idea.
Well, I can't tell on that because I don't know how close the
space
is or how big the space is.
Oh, well, you can see one of them fastened onto it. We're talking about something a few thousand feet in size. Not terribly big at all. You see, the reason, it sounds incredible. The numbers just sound preposterous. The reason that it is reasonable is that you are using the entire volume of it. You're used to thinking of using only the surface of a planet. Indeed, that's why probably the way to go as we move off the Earth is not moving to other planets and colonizing them. A, there's no other planet in the solar system with a decent environment and for human beings. B, they're hard to land on and take off from because they've got this heavy gravitational field things the Earth does. But C, why waste all that interior volume? Build your own world from the ground up, and you can use all of them. Okay, well, I can't give a space colonization lecture, much though I'd like to. You got to cut the open on November 2nd and hear that. I wanted to mention this because it is at least peripherally relevant to Phobos and Deimos, and because it is a brand new development, which probably many of you, I know some of you at least have been in my space colonization lecture that I gave here about a year and a half ago, and that is newer than that, but I wanted to mention at least that. After you use up all the asteroids? It's going to be an awfully long time before you use up all the asteroids. If you use all of the available material in low gravity environments of the solar system, all the asteroids, all the small moons, the outer planets, and so forth, which nobody gets to do, I'm just quoting in this number to show how much there is available, you could produce space colonies with a total land area 3,000 times that of the Earth, but all of it maximally productive. So it's going to be a while before we use it on Mars.
Well, yeah, okay, I can give a safe colonization lecture. Briefly, the answer to that is we have got to stabilize human population within a few centuries. And what space colonization offers is it buys a couple of centuries in which to do that. There's no way we're going to stabilize the human population if we remain behind on this planet. Too much of the human race is poor. It's the poor countries that have the high birth rate. And the reason for that is very simple. If you are really, really poor, it makes economic sense for you as an individual to have lots of kids, so that at least a few of them survive and take care of you in your old age, for sure nobody else is going to. But it's disastrous for the society. And, you know, the rich countries are the ones that have the low birth rate. So it is possible, at least, that if you move out of the state, use this very much greater amount of resources you have out there than you have on this one planet, thereby eliminating poverty for the human race, even though it's a somewhat larger rate than you've got now, that we will, in fact, be able to stabilize that population. I'm not promising. For one thing, I ain't going to be here when it happens. So, it's, you know, I suppose it would be a safe promise to make. But at least it seems as though it offers some hope. But at the very least, it buys a few centuries. Okay, listen, I can't take any more questions on space colonies. Okay, if you want to, you know, because otherwise, I mean, it's too long to lecture. It's not that I don't want to talk about it, obviously. But I was paying to come and give you a lecture about Phobos and Deimos, and I mentioned only this much because it was at least relevant to those a little. Did that kill your question?
It's a borderline.
Okay. It's borderline. It's
how fast that MIT mass driver got up to.
How fast it got up to?
Yeah, the velocity.
You got me there. It was fast enough that you could not see the thing move. All you knew was, you know, they gave a countdown so that you would know when they pressed the button, because otherwise you never would have. And as far as you could tell, you know, less than human eyes response time later, there was a bucket sitting in the styrofoam target that they fired it into. They fired it repeatedly at 35 G. And their target was designed so that it would stop the bucket with minimal damage. They made several buckets, and they did this one firing at 100 G, and they were willing to sacrifice the bucket for that. They did not have a target that would allow the bucket to survive. And that bucket was pretty thoroughly clean. But what the speed was, I don't know. I think I heard, as a matter of fact, and of course you could estimate it by, you know, doing the relevant calculations, taking the fact that it's 35 G's, and looking at the length of the mass driver, which must have been, what, a few tens of feet. But in my head, I'm not going to try to do that. Thank you. All right. Some people can do it their hands. Okay. 30 meters per second, which would be about 55 miles an hour. Meters per second times 2 1/4 is miles per hour. That one I learned thoroughly during biking. When you're reporting it to the public, you just got to convert it from metric into English. And they always gave wind speed in meters per second, which, by the way, is the metric speed. You know, all these speedometers and speed limit signs and so forth that we're going to have when we quote build metric and give feet in kilometers per hour. Kilometer per hour is not a metric unit, because the hour is not a metric unit. Well, it's not SI, which means metric now. You should use meters per second, but that's another substitute. Let's tell you about the shape, and that'll be enough before intermission. Here are a number of views from Mariner 9 of both Phobos and Deimos. And I think you can see that they are quite irregular, and they're very definitely not spherical. And if you think about it, actually, you might expect astronomical objects that are made of rock to be this way. I mean, consider a rock in your backyard. These are just big versions of a rock in your backyard, right? Is a rock in your backyard usually a perfect sphere? The Earth is certainly a perfect sphere. As you can see by looking at any picture of the Earth taken from space, like this Apollo 7 image of the Himalayas, the highest mountains on Earth, which shows the horizon there as an absolutely mathematically perfect circle, as far as you can tell. The highest mountains on Earth are only 7 miles high, measured from the bottom to the top, and those are not the Himalayas, that's Mauna Kea in Hawaii. We measure mountains traditionally from sea level, but of course that's an arbitrary datum. If you're talking about a deviation from spherical on a planetary body, what you're talking about is either the mountain from bottom to top. And Mauna Kea is the highest mountain defined in that respect, it's just that most of it happens to be underwater, so you tend not to think of it that way. And 7 miles is only 1/10 of 1% of the diameter of the Earth. Even the boldest of the equator, which is higher than any mountain,
is only 27 miles out of a diameter of 8,000 miles, and that is only 1/3 of 1%. So the Earth is, in fact, more nearly spherical than the average bowling ball. Some astronomers actually went to the trouble of checking that out. And it's a very good way of expressing it, because a bowling ball has to be very close to being a mathematical sphere, or else it will not do what it's supposed to do. Why then is the Earth spherical, the Sun, the Moon, and all the other bodies that you're used to thinking of, and yet Phobos and Deimos are not, and rocks in your backyard and rocks in the Moon are not? The answer is that if you have, well, let's suppose you try to start out with the Earth and turn it into some very definitely non-spherical shape, for example, a cube. A cube can be thought of as a sphere with eight big tall mountains in various places which will represent the corners of the cube. So you get your fleetest spaceship and you start piling on 30 to 30 tons of rock at each of eight places on the Earth, so to make it into a cube. You will discover that before you have piled it on very high, your corners of your cube, your mountains in other words, will mysteriously refuse to get any higher. And the reason for that is that the pressure at the bottom of the mountain, due to the weight of the overlying rock, becomes great enough that the rock fails at the bottom of the mountain. And it splits, or in the case of a really large mountain, it will actually flow like molasses, and it will move out sideways. Thereafter, you can pour on as much additional rock as you like and make the mountain as wide as you desire, but you can never make it any higher. How high can you make a mountain? On the Earth, with typical mountain-forming rocks, and there are only a few rocks that are common on the Earth or another planet, it turns out that that height from bottom to top is about 7 miles, which indeed is the height of the highest mountains that we have on this planet. So the reason you don't see any higher ones is simply that it is physically impossible for them to exist in this particular gravitational field. An analogy, you may not be used to thinking of a rock as something that will split and move out sideways or that will flow like molasses, but that is because rock, although it does not have incidence rates by any means, is of course a great deal stronger than what you can do with your bare hand. You don't think of taking a rock and stretching it out like tapping. But if you have large amounts of rock, indeed its strength is essentially zero. And that is the reason why you don't have rocks, why you don't have mountains that are higher than 7 miles on the Earth. Suppose, to take another example, that you could quarry out the lower peninsula of Michigan, and you have some sort of giant crane, and you fasten eyeballs in each of the four corners, trying to lift it clear of the Earth. You would very quickly discover that rock in large quantities have no strength. It would flow as though you were trying to lift out the Great Lakes instead of solid rock. You would find that no matter how high you pulled the corners up into the air, the center would obstinately remain stuck down where it was. If you tried to pick it up by the middle and pull it up, the four corners would droop down. A silly puzzle with very much less strength than that. And the only way that you could do it would be to take some sort of giant pie server and support the entire body of the entire thing. And even that is not even theoretically reasonable, because after all, what would you make your pie server out of? It too would become solid, and it would have essentially zero strength. The reason that rocks have such great strength in small quantities and so little strength in large quantities is that what holds it together and gives it that strength is interatomic forces. One atom is holding on to another atom very, very strongly if that other atom is right next to it. But if that other atom is, say, several atoms down the line, the force between the one we're talking about and that one several atoms down the line has fallen to essentially zero. These are short-range forces. It's like the old bit about the term of the house that was so decrepit that all that held it together was the termites holding hands. If one pair of termites let go, the whole house falls apart. Same sort of thing with interatomic forces. Interatomic forces are very strong, short range. You can pull a rock apart with your bare hands. But imagine that you pull up the state of Michigan and the bonds between each pair of atoms bend by just a millionth of a degree. I think you can see you don't have to go very far down the line before that bend has reached 180 degrees, because atoms are so terribly, terribly tiny. So in large quantities, rock has essentially zero strength. Okay, that's on the Earth. On Earth, you cannot have a mountain higher than 7 miles. But suppose you go to Mars. Mars has only 1/3 the gravity of the Earth. Therefore, a rock or anything else weighs only 1/3 as much as it would on Earth. Therefore, you can pile it up 3 times as high before the pressure down near the bottom, the critical pressure that makes the rock fail, has become the same as it would be for a 7-mile mountain on Earth.
In other words, you could have a mountain on Mars 21 miles high. And indeed you do. The highest mountains on Mars, the great volcanoes, the Tharsis region, are 15 miles measured from bottom to top, but they are sitting on the Tharsis Dome, which is a great bulge, a blister in the planet's crust, which is an additional 6 miles high. So when you count the entire amount, they are 21 miles in height. The Moon has a gravity that's only half that of Mars. So in principle, on the Moon, you can have mountains that are 42 miles high. But you don't. The highest mountains on the Moon, for example, Mount Hatteras, which I showed in one of the Moon lectures, are actually lower than the highest mountains on Earth. So by this really very simple physics, we have come to a major distinction between the Earth and Mars on one hand and the Moon on the other. The Earth and Mars have mountain-building activity that is strong enough that it has created mountains as high as those planets can possibly have. The Moon does not. In fact, as you will recall when we were here for the first Moon lecture, the mountains on the Moon are not of internal origin at all. They are simply the rims of the very biggest craters on the Moon, the so-called basins that are hundreds of miles across. They are formed by external activity, and their size is determined not by anything having to do with what's going on inside the Moon, but by the physics of what happened when the meteorite. Now, as you get down to smaller and smaller planets, then, two things happen. First of all, you can have higher and higher mountains. Whether you do or not, it's a function of what happens to the landscape of the planet, but at least it's possible. And, number two, of course, a mountain of a given height becomes a greater and greater fraction of the size of the planet, right? A 7-mile-high mountain is only a tiny pinprick on the Earth. But if it's on top of a 7-mile diameter asteroid, it is such a deviation from spherity that you can't refer to the asteroid as being spherical anymore. And besides, that asteroid can have mountains that are much higher than 7 miles. So what happens is that as you go down to lower and lower sizes, there is a rather sudden transition at diameter of about 300 miles between bodies bigger than that that have to be essentially spherical with mountains that are both minor fractions of their diameters and size, and bodies below that diameter that do not have to be spherical and frequently aren't. Those are bodies that are not held together primarily by their own gravity, as the Earth is. Those are bodies that are held together primarily by the interatomic forces, which are what hold together any small rock. For the phrase small rock here, read anything bigger than about 300 miles across. Phobos and Deimos, of course, are considerably smaller than that, so they don't have to be spherical, and indeed, as you see, they are not. There is, however, one more little interesting item about their shapes, and that is, both of them are relatively irregular. They have gouges out of them where apparently meteorites hit by them, but both of them are pretty close to being triaxial ellipsoids. That is, well, it's easy to explain that by showing you the slide. An ellipsoid is some triaxial ellipsoid is something which has no circular cross section. All three of its possible cross sections, right, three mutually perpendicular directions, are elliptical. And the interesting thing is that although they are different in size, they're the same shape. When this particular drawing appeared in Scientific American, the caption writer wrote, "The similarity between the two moon shapes is unexplained." We now think we know the reason for it. This shape is just what you get if you take a rock in the laboratory, a small rock now, one that's not held together by its own gravity, but you can do this in the laboratory, and you smack an even smaller projectile into it so hard that you begin to shatter the rock. What tends to happen, if you did it really hard, a really big projectile, you simply break it apart into a cloud of dust. But if you do it just barely above the size that's necessary to shatter, what happens is the sheets of rock fall off. Fall is a geologic term meaning a sheet of rock breaking off and sliding off as a result of an impact on the rock. And the shape that you get left over is exactly the shape. So, although, as I showed you earlier, neither Phobos nor Deimos have ever been very much bigger than they are now, apparently both of them were once somewhat bigger than they are now, and heaven knows what shape they had, and both of them underwent collisions that were violent enough to fall off their outer shells and leave behind these ellipsoidal shapes, which is the thing that we know and love today. And note, of course, that afterwards, both moons were hit by smaller bodies, which covered both of them with craters. That's a good place for an intermission. After the intermission, I will show you the truly spectacular, extreme close-up pictures taken by the two Russian orbiters of Deimos and Phobos, and show you some highly unexpected features which were found on the surfaces of both moons.